Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Meredith E. Gansner, MD, who is an attending child psychiatrist at Boston Children's Hospital and instructor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Her award-winning research focuses on adolescent mental health and problematic digital media use. Dr. Gansner lives in the Boston area with her husband and two children, and the book that we're talking about today is Teen Depression Gone Viral, Why Kids Are More Vulnerable Than Ever, and How You Can Protect Your Child's Health and Happiness. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Dr. Gansner.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Is it okay if I call you Meredith while we're talking?
Totally fine.
Okay. All right. So why did you decide to write this book?
I decided to write this book because for the last 10 to 12 years, which I think coincidentally has been the time that I've been in medicine, and also when I think we've seen a tremendous evolution in social media and digital media and its impact on youth mental health. And for that, 10 to 12 years, I've seen us, I think, fall further and further behind when it comes to finding ways to help families tackle how to protect their children from problematic use of the internet or social media. And certainly that isn't to say there aren't benefits to this technology, but I think for kids who are struggling with depression or anxiety, and even for their parents or guardians, the internet can be a really overwhelming place for a variety of different reasons. And so when COVID hit, I was working in inpatient psychiatry, and because kids were online far more because of remote schooling, we were just seeing again and again issues related to things that happened online that were worsening kind of underlying psychiatric conditions. And parents were so trapped because they knew that the child had to have access to the devices, but simultaneously they realized that it was not also problematic for the other kids and potentially making their symptoms worse. And I felt like we haven't, as a society, as researchers, as clinicians, as policymakers, done enough to provide and research concrete evidence of how to tackle a variety of issues online and how to stay safe online. And so this book sort of came out of my desire to provide more concrete guidance to parents in, I think, what can be a very overwhelming process, right? And when your child has depression, it's incredibly challenging, but I think the digital aspect of it actually can make things even more confusing.
Well, one thing that surprised me when I started reading the book is that you're actually making the point that the internet probably isn't causing the depression, at least not
right
by itself.
Yes, exactly. Probably not in and of itself.
Yeah. It may be making things worse, mm-hmm. but in some cases it can make things better too.
Yeah. And unfortunately, we really don't have the ability to do research studies that could, without a doubt, prove the internet is the problem. I mean, we can't have some teens go on certain platforms and only, I guess, one type of platform for a certain period of time, and others don't. I mean, everyone's experience online is different, and everyone's experience using devices is different. And so it's just an incredibly challenging study that we haven't been able to pull off, and I don't know that we'll be able to. So really, I think trying to find a way that we can live with these devices safely is our best bet.
Well, I sometimes wonder if kids are, the younger kids are getting smarter about it.
I know, right? My toddler is awesome. I guess she's not a toddler anymore, but she is shockingly good at figuring out how to get onto devices and navigate them. More so than I think I would have been at her age.
Oh, yeah. And not just that, but also maybe smarter about understanding what's good and what's not good. And, for example, my grandkids are digital natives, and I think they're both pretty skeptical about a lot of social media.
Great.
More so than older teens would be, possibly, or people in their 20s.
Yeah, I think that's amazing to hear. I have also increasingly met, I think, younger Gen, I guess younger Gen Zers who have been, I think you're right, more skeptical, more careful about what it means to be on social media and what it means to have one's identity out there in the world, and even what it means to spend that much time when you're just looking at a screen. But I think, as a psychiatrist, the kids and I guess Gen Alpha and younger Gen Z that have underlying psychiatric issues, that tends to be, I think, where you start seeing more problematic use hit. And so this book, I was hoping in part could, help those kids because by and large, they don't seem to be looked at as much in studies. It's far less likely for people to do studies specifically in youth that have underlying psychiatric conditions. Most of the research is in kind of the general adolescent or young adult populations. And so I really wanted this book to can be for those families that I see.
Okay, so when you talk about depression, you start out with sort of splitting it into three types of depression or three levels. I don't, what would you say exactly? How would you?
So I mean, there are certainly like different types of depression that one sees kind of more commonly amongst youth. And I mentioned three specifically in the book. But then there's also differing levels of severity of depression. And so we kind of think of it as like mild, moderate, and severe are how we most often categorize depression.
So the statistic that shocked me comes right at the beginning of the book when you're talking about major depressive disorder, which would be the most severe. And it said that in 2021, around 20% of 12 to 17-year-olds in the US had received an MDD diagnosis.
Unfortunately, the rate of depression diagnosis among teens is increasing. It has been even before COVID. And I think there are some reasons to think it's due to decreased stigma surrounding the illness and due to potentially increased screening, as there is now universal screening recommended by the American Academy of Pediatrics. But there's also concern that just in general, youth mental health is worsening significantly. And there are many different reasons floated about as to why that might be, some of which I mentioned in the book. But honestly, we don't know for 100% why that is.
It's really kind of, reading this, I almost got discouraged in a way. I mean, I know that's not your intention, but it's
Oh
like, but like, oh, if we could just get these kids through this stage, and adolescence has always been hard. It's
Oh,
always been tough,
absolutely.
but it just seems like it's so much harder now.
I think very much so. There are just aspects of youth that I mean, they just do seem markedly different. And I think that's just, I see it, even my eldest is in elementary school, but, there are kids already in elementary school who are highly scheduled and have all these activities that they're a part of already. And I do reflect on, how much of childhood, just the playing aspect of it might be lost and how already by the time that, youth and I guess, elementary school age kids turn into tweens and then turn into teens. There is a significant amount of childhood that is already been kind of taken over by this scheduling and kind of forced activities, and not as much as kind of experimenting with, different types of play and imagination and being bored, which is something that I feel like kids today just never learn how to do. At all, right? Like I think it's so hard. My daughter's always like, I'm so bored. I'm like, this is a learning opportunity. I know you hate being bored, but being bored can actually be good. But it's really hard. I think kids don't get that chance. And then oftentimes there's a difficulty with learning how to cope that also comes with that. And then you throw in a bunch of stressors and differing vulnerabilities, maybe poor sleep or poor appetite and family history. And then I think depression can come, I guess, a lot more easily with all those things in place. But again, I mean, there's no concrete evidence that suggests that that is true, but the rates where depression does seem to be increasing the most are in developed countries where there is this, I think, change in how youth navigate their earlier years in terms of play, like free play and being bored versus structured activities.
Of course, like you mentioned before, developed countries are also where the stigma has been reduced, where the screening has increased. And so it's possible that it isn't actually more, it's just more recognized.
That is definitely, definitely true. I think we're certainly going to be on the lookout as well for, you know, other countries that are developing nations that are becoming more like higher socioeconomic status nations are probably going to, I don't know, maybe have a see a shift. If we see a shift in those countries too, maybe we'll have a better sense, but it's hard to know right now where things are going.
Yeah. So kind of walk us through how your book is structured, the different areas that you write about in the book.
Yeah. So it's ideally kind of split along the lines of sort of how kind of logically one might progress through a depressive episode. And that being said, there is no right way to have a depressive episode and everyone's experience will be different. But it starts off talking about diagnosis, kind of what depression is, what we know about it, what we don't know about it, and what it looks like and what it looks like to parents and sometimes what it, you know, feels like to teenagers. And then it moves into talking a little bit about what might cause depression. That's and kind of what we've talking about just now in different theories as to what factors come together to produce a depressive episode. Then moves into talking about treatment, the different kind of pillars of treatment in adolescent depression. There are three. There's kind of lifestyle changes, so thinking about making changes to exercise and sleep. And then there are therapies. There are many different types of therapies. A couple of them are kind of particularly recommended for adolescent depression, and medications is the third. And then it moves into kind of talking about what can happen when depressive episodes can get, I guess, particularly complicated by risky behaviors and sort of all the kind of differing risky behaviors that have been associated with teen depression, of which there are many, and certainly the scariest being suicidal ideation and suicidality. And then it talks about, you know, obviously worst case scenario, what happens if your child needs to go into the hospital for their depression and how to navigate that. And understandably, parents' fears about that. And then concludes with kind of talking about recovery and how to think about recovery for both the parent, because it is exhausting having a child with depression. It's so heartbreaking for parents. And of course, recovery for the child as well.
Okay. So we could, you know, we could talk an hour on each one of these topics probably, but let's talk a little bit more about the causes. So what do you see as the kind of the major causes?
So there's just really is never. I guess say never, I guess maybe there could be one episode of depression out there, right, that is caused by one single thing. But that is definitely the minority. The vast majority of episodes of depression are thought to be caused by a different constellation of various risk factors that can all come together. And the thinking is you actually probably do have to have multiple of these risk factors within even multiple categories of risk factor to bring about an episode of depression. Thinking of things like, right, genetics, if you have a family history of depression or certainly a family history of suicidal ideation or suicide attempts, those are really significantly worrisome risk factors for a future history of depression. And then there are kind of additional stressors that can add on to that, some of which might be, you know, psychosocial stressors. So thinking of things like Trauma exposures, divorce, parents divorcing, issues with friends, bullying. And then there are also stressors, like physical stressors, so medical illnesses. There are certainly many chronic medical illnesses that are known to have increased risk of depression. There are certain also medications and both, I guess, illicit drugs and medication that are associated with depression. And then, certain things like lack of exercise, lack of certain vitamins, and lack of sunlight. Those are poor sleep. Sorry, I can't believe I forgot sleep. All of these things can be kind of different factors that will overlap. And thinking is, once these kind of all come together, that a person can be at far greater risk than for having a depressive episode.
It's interesting you talk about chronic illnesses where depression can be, obviously it can be just because you're having to deal with this chronic illness that's depressing in and of itself. But years ago, I had the worst episode of flu that I've ever had. I've really only ever had it that once, and that was like almost 10 years ago. And a week or so afterwards, I realized I was feeling really down, and I was like, what is going on? And I looked, here's where the internet's useful. I Googled it and found out that depression can be a side effect of the flu. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's what's going on. And then I didn't worry about it because I knew it was going to pass.
It's interesting that you mentioned the flu specifically because when I used to do night float for training back in residency, I did adult training first and then child training. And I remember we would have a lot of individuals would come in with suicidal thoughts and potentially suicide attempts. And especially during the winter months, right? There were more than I would have thought that had would get tested for the flu, wouldn't really have maybe many symptoms, but would be positive for flu. And there is a lot of literature that suggests that information inflammation and illnesses that can cause inflammation, that is kind of highly correlative with depression as well in terms of it being an inflammatory process. And we don't really know exactly what causes depression inside the body, like what exact chemicals are going awry. But we have known for a while that when people are significantly depressed, there do seem to be some markers of inflammation too. So it's really interesting that you mentioned the flu because I had that thought previously too.
And for me, because I'm normally very upbeat and don't have any issues with depression, that just recognizing that that was the underlying cause made it easy for me to pull out of it, basically. And maybe it would help other people too, because sometimes I feel like if something like that is causing depression, you can spiral down. Because you don't know what's causing it.
And it's very scary. And I think, especially adults are pretty good at having that level of insight. Not all of them, certainly, but are I think when they kind of have the foresight to say, okay, like this is time limited. But younger individuals, especially teens, tend to struggle with that, and they don't have a great sense of, this week sounds like forever, whereas, for adults, it's like a second.
This too shall
And so.
pass.
Exactly. It's so hard for them. Like my daughter, I'll be like 20. I mean, she's not a teenager yet, but 20 seconds for her is a lifetime. So, but absolutely, I think that when parents have more information, and sometimes the teens as well have more information about various things that could be contributing, that definitely can be empowering to know kind of what you could do to try to make the symptoms a little bit better, because if there are so many different factors that could be involved, it means there are also many different factors you can try to address. So I think that is important.
Now, how frequent is it that the teen is unwilling to acknowledge that they have a problem?
I mean, I admittedly don't know that I've ever come across like a really large research study that has looked at that. But I anecdotally, I would say, it happens. I think it always sort of happened probably like 20, 30% of the time where a child might just deny that, like, they're no, like, it's fine, you know, I don't have anything that's going on, nothing's wrong. It's like, no, that seems, there seems to be a depression afoot. But it, more recently, it's actually been not only nothing's wrong, but also, no, I don't have depression. I have a different psychiatric illness that they probably do not have based on the diagnostic criteria of that illness and the symptoms that they're showing. And so that's been a noticeable shift because I think it's been great that psychiatric illness is far less stigmatized. I think it, in part due to social media platforms trying to kind of increase awareness. But that being said, it has also drawn attention to certain psychiatric disorders that it may seem less scary than depression, or maybe don't seem or seem
Cooler,
I don't
maybe.
Yeah, cooler, more exciting. And when you know that's, you know, certainly the people who actually who do have those illnesses would argue differently that no, in fact, those are incredibly challenging illnesses to have. And so that has been in the last, you know, 5 years or so since COVID, something that we've been seeing more and more of.
So, kind of a self-diagnosis based on limited information.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or, you know, they might acknowledge that they have a depressive disorder, but they really identify more with this new disorder that they have. Sometimes it's autism, sometimes it's dissociative identity disorder. Those are probably the two big ones. I last week had a patient who cited a very rare kind of delusional disorder that I mean, I had not heard of this for. It's been about a decade, you know, since I took my board exams. I was took me by surprise. I was like, oh my goodness, how did you ever stumble across that? And you know, there was no evidence that that was actually, you know, there. But especially because she had insight into it, which is not usual. But yeah, it was shocking. It seems to change, you know, every year.
And in your book, you also a couple times mentioned that bipolar disorder is much more rare than people think it is, that there
Yeah.
seems to be more people who think they have bipolar disorder than is actually the case.
Yeah, I'm hoping that this is sort of on the way out, that sort of thinking. Back, I guess when I was maybe a teenager, maybe I guess maybe a young adult teenager, there was a uptick in bipolar diagnoses out of concern that this really kind of intense irritability might actually be kind of a precursor to bipolar disorder, and that these individuals actually had bipolar disorder when in fact when they were followed out over longer periods of time, and we had the benefit of many years of data, it seemed like no, that kind of intense irritability seemed to be more like depression or depressive disorders than bipolar disorder, which is good because the medications for bipolar disorder are hard to be on, and the illness itself is very scary. So we're glad that that doesn't seem to have been the case.
Oh, that is good. Yeah, 'cause I think it's easy, you know, we all know people who seem to have moods, you know, wild mood swings.
Yep.
So what is the line between that and having a bipolar disorder?
Yeah, I mean, there are kind of differing degrees of bipolar disorder, right? There's a bipolar 2, which is considered to be a little bit less severe in its symptoms than bipolar 1. But I think that the symptoms really do need to be notable and life kind of limiting for a longer period of time than just, you know, half an hour. You know, you shouldn't be, if you're really excited for half an hour and really have, you know, tons of energy, and then the next half an hour you're really angry, or even like a few hours, right? That's not that that's more mood lability, but not necessarily bipolar disorder. But when you have kind of very high moods or very low moods for longer periods of time and it's sustained, at that point, that is far more concerning. And you usually expect to see them, it's not as though you see like kind of one symptom for a while, right? Like thinking about a, you know, manic episode, right? It's not like you would have tons and tons of energy and then the next hour you have like a desire to, you know, shop a ton, or they would occur all at the same time and not, you know, just not really picking and choosing one at a time. So that's how I try to tease them apart, is that really you kind of you expect it to be something that is sustained rather than just, you know, for a
Okay,
couple of hours.
so I feel like at some point I had learned about that there was a form of bipolar disorder that was called rapid cycle, where you went back and forth really
There
quickly. And but you're
is.
saying that's not really bipolar disorder?
No, there are people who do appear to have more rapid cycling, but it usually isn't the same as you know, the individuals I see who will say like, oh, for like an hour or so I was manic, right? That's not, it's not to that degree where you would have that flipping so quickly.
Okay.
Usually the diagnoses, you know, you would go traditionally, right, when you're not rapid cycling, it's like thinking about, you know, a week or so of having those symptoms sustained. I think a few days of those symptoms sustained, that would be concerning. And again, kind of all of them together, rather than just kind of one or two. Those are the things that I would look for. So.
Okay, so moving into the treatment section, you talk about lifestyle treatments, therapy and medication. What are the primary lifestyle treatments, and are they sometimes enough?
So second question first, maybe there certainly may be people out there who are able to treat their depression with only lifestyle related changes. And I think that probably would have to do in large part to how significant the symptoms are, because right, the less severe your depression, the better able you will be to do some of these things, which we're thinking about, you know, fixing your sleep, making sure you're sleeping enough, or not sleeping too much. That's also a red flag. Making sure that you are eating and trying, if you can, to kind of eat balanced, more nutritious meals. But certainly just eating is a good place to start if that is where an individual is at. And then trying to also get some amount of exercise. There is good literature, especially in adults, that, you know, moderate, at least kind of moderate, more than moderate exercise where you're getting an elevated heart rate, can be highly beneficial for the treatment of depression. But we don't have the evidence we need to say that, especially in teenagers, that's the alone treatment that will, you know, fix depression. Like exercise alone probably does not fix a depressive episode. But you know, maybe it could for somebody, but that typically wouldn't be what we would recommend. We recommend trying to address multiple areas of issues, so sleep and appetite and eating and lifestyle changes like that. So UV light exposure is another one too.
Oh, okay. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so seasonal affective disorder is definitely real. And you know, for those individuals who do have this very consistent seasonal pattern to their depression, where as soon as the days get shorter and everything gets darker and they get decreased light UV light exposure, they get depressed. UV light therapy is highly effective for those individuals. Unfortunately, not everybody has that kind of depression or that kind of I guess seasonal component or element to it. And so for them, UV light exposure might not be as helpful. But even, you know, when it's not, even when it's not, you know, winter and it's not really dark outside, if an individual is so depressed that they're not leaving their home and they're just sitting in the dark, right, on their computer, then it's also worth figuring out how they can find ways to get that UV light exposure, to at least get them outside. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, it has the benefit of not just the light, but if you're getting outside, you're probably getting some exercise.
Yes, ideally.
Yeah.
And that's a good place to start. That's definitely a good place to start.
Yeah. And just fresh air and contact with nature. Now, I don't think you really address that too much in here, but do you feel that more contact with nature can be helpful?
Personally, yes. I think I absolutely find nature to be incredibly therapeutic. I don't think we've been very successful as a field researching kind of nature therapy specifically in teens and how that would help. But as you said, like you get UV light exposure, you can get exercise, and I think you also get a time where you can ideally kind of separate yourself from outside stressors and other things that might be competing for your attention. What gets tricky though is that many teens tend to actually struggle when they're depressed, struggle most when they are alone and don't have those distractions. So it is certainly something that might be more helpful to them once they are better able to kind of filter out some of those negative thoughts. Because if they're, by themselves and they don't have like their phone, right, to challenge, difficult, uncomfortable emotions that they're having, sometimes that can be really scary for them. But I know personally, I definitely think depressive symptoms can be relieved by, being out there in nature and that kind of calm.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Dr. Meredith Gansner, author of Teen Depression Gone Viral: Why Kids Are More Vulnerable Than Ever and How You Can Protect Your Child's Health and Happiness. So you did mention that there's a number of types of therapy that seem to be most effective in dealing with adolescents. Do you want to kind of describe those?
Yeah, so my soapbox regarding this is the best kind of therapy for your child who is depressed, first and foremost, is just getting them to go to therapy. And that also would just include finding someone that they feel comfortable enough with to continue seeing. It doesn't matter what kind of therapy your child is receiving, if they won't even go to their appointments, that's not going to help anyone. And so I try to help parents understand that, first and foremost, that's the biggest consideration, having a child be comfortable enough to go to therapy sessions. There are two types of therapy that are kind of best known or I guess best studied also in treating adolescent depression. That's cognitive behavioral therapy, which we frequently just call CBT. And then there's also interpersonal therapy as well, IPT. And the CBT involves really kind of taking negative thoughts that people might have and finding ways to challenge them and kind of restructure your thinking so that your negative emotions, like I'm worthless, nobody likes me, don't start impacting your behaviors, and which they often do, right? So if someone constantly thinks that everybody hates them, they might never go out with any of their friends. They get more isolated. Their friends maybe stop inviting them to hang out because that person never goes out with them when they do ask. And so then it reinforces this belief that nobody likes them. And so trying to find a way to break that cycle is really important for many different psychiatric disorders, not just depression, but is also helpful in depression. And IPT, interpersonal therapy, is really kind of doing a deep dive into different interpersonal relationships and trying to kind of optimize those interpersonal relations so that I guess really so the kind of communication is improved and the person is also able to kind of get what they are. I guess, sorry, more articulately, as I say, non-articulately, more articulately kind of make their needs get met. And so that can be increased communication can be so incredibly helpful, when you are struggling with depression and especially those people who are closest to you. But there are also other therapies that have been studied for like looking at depression symptoms, and they might not be, the best, most evidence-based, but they can be helpful. Even, just regular kind of talk therapy can be helpful too. It is just harder to study because it doesn't have this sort of manual and certain steps that one follows, like one does with CBT and IPT. So,
So every therapist might do it a little differently.
yeah, they
And
often do. So it makes it hard. And I also say, family therapy. When you, so that would be still deals with kind of the relationships in the family specifically, but as opposed to it just being the patient who's undergoing that therapy and learning how to relate differently to others, this is the whole family unit would attend the therapy and try to work out some of their kind of structural issues within the family. In that sense, it might be kind of incidentally, prolonging depressive symptoms or prolonging behaviors or enabling behaviors that are then making recovery harder. And I think it can be really hard to convince families to do family therapy, but I think it could be tremendously helpful and have a significant benefit, not just obviously for the child, but for the whole family system.
So if you had a child who maybe was reluctant to do therapy on their own but would be willing to go with the family, or maybe the family can only afford one type of therapy.
Yeah.
Which would you push for the most? I guess the family therapy or the individual therapy?
Yeah, I mean, from a practical standpoint, I think insurances, because in the US that is something we do have to worry about, and insurance would I be more likely to cover kind of individual therapy for a treatment for depression. So that is a big consideration, right? Because therapy can be expensive if it's out of pocket. Sometimes therapists will try to incorporate like the family as possible with family sessions potentially here and there. I can't speak for every therapist, but many do. And certainly they would always involve a parent guardian when treating a teenager anyway. But this would be sometimes even, having the parent come into a session if it was thought that that could be helpful.
So, Dr. Gansner, why don't you read a little bit from Teen Depression Gone Viral?
Sure. So I picked first a section about kind of why I wrote this book and kind of my frame of thinking in terms of why write a new book about depression and how I really wrote this book to kind of give a thank you to my patients and their families that I've had over the years. So, full disclosure, the foremost expert on your teen's depression is probably your teen, but you and I both know that teenagers aren't always great at talking about their feelings, especially to their parents. They do sometimes talk to me, a child and adolescent psychiatrist who has seen depression present itself in a wide variety of settings: outpatient clinics, emergency rooms, medical floors, and inpatient psychiatric units, to name a few. I've also spent the last decade researching digital media use, specifically in adolescents with psychiatric disorders like depression. The combination of my research and clinical experience has given me perspective on the management of adolescent depression in our screen-dependent society. I am also quite the avid Googler, but this is apparently not an actual credential. Many parents have asked me about what they read online and about the potential adverse effects of continuous digital media use. However, there is only so much information that can reasonably be covered during an emergency room assessment or 30-minute outpatient visits. Parents understandably prioritize questions like, what exactly is an antidepressant, over questions like, should I purchase a parental control app? Ideally, this book will answer some of the digital media-related questions that you haven't yet been able to ask. While many of these questions have answers that aren't one size fits all, my responses should at least help you identify solutions that could work for your family. Ultimately, I wrote this book out of admiration for the parents and families, oh, sorry, patients and families who had to learn for themselves how digital media influenced adolescent depression. These families shouldn't have been burdened with navigating dangerous online challenges or cyberbullying all on their own, yet burdened they were. And I hope this book can save future families from having to learn through trial by fire. So that is one section.
All right.
And should I move to the second section?
Sure.
All right. So for the second section, I picked so actually flipped right to the very end in terms of thinking about moving forward from a depressive episode. So final thoughts. Supporting a teenager with depression is an undeniably tough job. To close out this book, I was searching for a metaphor that captured just how much of a struggle adolescent depression can be for both teenager and caregiver. And when I thought about all that is required to help your teenager navigate their illness, it hit me. It's rather a fitting metaphor given the screen-focused book. The journey through adolescent depression is like an immersive video game, one that only your teenager owns. Think about it. When you start a new video game, right out of the gate, you're thrown into a strange world that you have to learn how to navigate, sometimes by yourself, sometimes with others. To survive in this world, you have to try new things, test things out, learn new skills, and fail at times. At each level, you encounter an incredibly difficult opponent, but eventually you figure out how to beat that opponent and win that level. Then, after some time, you might start a new level of the game. The next level is different from the first one, and the level after that one will be different as well. Each new level brings new challenges that you have to figure out how to tackle. However, although no level is exactly the same, the levels aren't entirely disconnected from each other either. You can use some of the valuable skills you learned at the earlier levels against similar foes in the later levels. For example, maybe on level one, you figured out that a magic flower temporarily protects you from your enemies, and now you can use that to your advantage whenever you see the same magic flower in level four or level five. Each new level feels hard at the beginning, but all the levels that you've already beaten feel impossible at the start too, and yet you still made it through that and moved forward. If your child has a relapse and illness, every new depressive episode will feel like a brand new level, but they're never starting right at the beginning. With each depressive episode, your child will become better at recognizing the warning signs, identifying triggers for their illness, and knowing what makes their symptoms better. Each level gives them the opportunity to practice and move on and improve on the skills that they learned during the prior episodes. They will get angry and they will get frustrated, and they might even want to give up sometimes. And that's where you come in. Because although I gave you a seemingly infinite number of different recommendations in this book, none of them work quite as well without you. You're a critical part of the safety plans, behavior plans, medication taking, and the therapeutic interventions. You can't defeat your teen's depression for them, but you're also not watching helplessly from the sidelines either. You're a critical supporting character in their journey to beat depression. Along this journey, you may find yourself overwhelmed and drowning in decision-making. You will question whether your teen should have access to social media, whether their daily walk is enough exercise to be helpful for their symptoms, or if they might benefit from an additional medication for sleep. You will get caught up worrying about how long you have until they relapse, whether there's something you can do to make sure they don't get depressed before finals, or whether they'll ever be able to hold down a job because of their illness. You'll feel pushed to your limits as you attempt to map out an ideal path forward. And when you're at this point of paralysis, trying to figure out which direction your teen needs to go next, remember this. A route can be meticulously mapped out, but it's all for nothing if a person decides to stay in place. The most important thing you can do for your teen is to keep encouraging them to put one foot in front of the other. So take a deep breath and just focus on reaching the end of this level. You've got this.
Thank you. And that's Dr. Meredith Gansner reading from Teen Depression Gone Viral. Do we know if people who suffered from depression as adolescents sometimes outgrow it?
There are people that may have depressive episodes in adolescence and don't have relapse. Unfortunately, though, the relapse rate is quite high. So chances are good, more good than not, that there will be another episode. But, you know, certainly if there are aspects of the depression that are potentially better addressed, right, when they become an adult. So maybe they are better able to manage their stress in different ways, or get more regular exercise, or better sleep, better eating habits, all those things. I mean, it could be possible that they wouldn't have depression anymore, or at least would be less likely to get a depressive episode.
In some ways, social interactions become easier when you're an adult.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Because yes. You're not forced into this sort of, you know, the high school venue where everybody's being judged in some sense, mm-hmm. or you feel like everybody's being judged. And, you know, as an adult, you look back and you think, oh, why did that matter so much? What people thought, you know, why did that matter? But it does so much at that. I mean, is there some way we can change that?
I know. It would be so nice to have that ability, right? To that, you know, from the get-go when you're younger, realize like, no, this isn't, I promise, this isn't actually as important as you think that it is.
That person who seems to be on top of the world looking down at you now in 20 years is going to be nothing to you.
Yeah. It is so hard. I mean, certainly many parents, will try to impart that advice onto their children, but it often falls on deaf ears. I mean, it does when I try it with my own child as well. But especially when someone is depressed, right? They just really don't have that ability to recognize, you know, when a social interaction may not really be beneficial at all. It's one of the really frustrating things about both being an adolescent and parenting an adolescent, for sure.
Wow. Now, in the book, you talk about these plans that you can make, that mm-hmm. parents and teens can make together. You have a safety plan, a behavior plan, and a media plan. Do you want to tell a little bit about those?
Yeah. So certainly a person can get through a depressive episode without making one of these plans. Behavior and safety plans, I think, are really most beneficial when either the depression is associated with some pretty scary, risky behaviors, or alternatively is so severe that there are behaviors, for example, like, you know, sleeping enough or getting out for exercise, like just aren't happening at all. And so, you know, when I think about trying to tackle those problems, it can be really helpful to have something concrete to incentivize teens to engage in behaviors that would be more healthy for them, either behaviors that, you know, are like pro-healthy behaviors, right? So like increased exercise, you know, eating 3 meals a day, things like that, or avoiding risky behaviors that could potentially worsen their symptoms, like drug use. Those are, I think, nicely tackled with something that a parent and a child can create together, and then look at and figure out, okay, you know, how can we move forward in a way that, you know, keeps you safe, that I know what helps you and what doesn't help you. You know, the safety plan is, as the name suggests, is more focused on, you know, what makes a child feel unsafe. And I'm thinking of, you know, oftentimes thoughts of wanting to hurt oneself, but it could also be thought to hurt somebody else, or it could be just kind of a really significant rage that a child has. Anytime when they have a very like uncomfortable emotions or feelings that lead to unsafe behaviors, that can be a good place for a safety plan to be created, to allow the child to communicate their level of safety to all the adults in their lives that would be helping to support them. But also it would allow the parent to better understand what could be helpful in those moments when the child is feeling, you know, maybe mildly uncomfortable versus like really having very significant thoughts of wanting to hurt themselves or others. The behavioral plan can be, excuse me, can be either addressing kind of risky behaviors like substance use, or as I said, it could be, you know, a way to incentivize walks instead of screen time. And both can be created. One can certainly have both if the need arises. And the digital media plan, I know, like tackling a third plan would just, it would be too much for a family. So I often recommend, and I recommend in my book, trying to fold in some of the digital media behavioral plan aspects into the behavior plan, because, you know, it's a behavior, and it's not really an adaptive behavior. I mean, it's a behavior that arises often because kids who are depressed are struggling to feel good about themselves, or struggling to detach from their negative thoughts. So screens become a really helpful coping skill for many of them. But right, it produces kind of more problems than aid sometimes. So that's where kind of putting digital media related components into a behavior plan comes in.
So, you know, even though you have a lot of information in each chapter about how the online world affects each of these areas, again, I want to emphasize it's not, the whole book isn't about blaming digital media for,
no. for no, the definitely problem. Not. No, and I think, I actually think something that maybe I don't emphasize enough when I'm asked to talk about the book is that it's there's certainly a lot of talking about how digital media can impact adolescent mental health, but it's also talking about how digital media and parental use of social media platforms and digital media can be detrimental for them too when their child is depressed, because there are so many differing streams of advice out there that parents are subject to online. And so that can be so overwhelming for parents to see all these different things that their child should be doing differently. And to try to do all of them, it can make you feel like you're failing your child if you aren't able to make certain things happen. And that's really just the nature of the internet. I mean, the internet is now designed to try to capture people's attention, and it tries to be black and white in its thinking, and as alarmist in its presentation as possible, because that's what gets people interested. And I think parents can easily fall into that trap, right? Even just seeing articles like, you know, teens suicidal because of social media. I mean, that's so scary for parents. But as you said, like, that's not the whole picture. That's not accurate.
Yeah.
And so having, hopefully with this book, having a guide saying, like, I promise, like, these headlines are scary and alarming, but like there's more to it than that. It's more nuanced than that. I'm hoping that parents can realize just how much the internet's playing them too. It's playing all of us in terms of manipulating our thoughts and how we think about things.
And there's so much anti-science, misinformation.
No, for sure. For sure. And unfortunately, I don't think that's going to get any better in the next few years.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. Well, we don't have a lot of time left, Meredith, but let's talk a little bit about your writing process with this book. I mean, you have, it sounds like, two jobs in addition to writing. As an attending psychiatrist and then as an instructor at Harvard Medical School. So how did you fit in writing a book?
Well, fortunately,
Oh, three jobs, mother. Got to
oh yeah,
count that one
that is true.
too.
Fortunately, I do have a very understanding spouse. So he also works. He does mostly research, and he works so hard. And so he wasn't necessarily put out of place when I, need to work on writing later in the evenings. And so I just tried to kind of fit in writing whenever I could, whenever I had downtime. I think the nature of the work that I do, it's been on kind of services that don't have like a predictable arc to them in terms of, there's something structured like every single hour. Sometimes there can be, but there are also like half hour periods where there might be some downtime. And so I tried to fit it in pretty much where I could. And I spend a lot of time sort of writing and thinking to myself in my head. And so, I commute in out of the city, and it takes an hour and a half sometimes. And so I found that could be a really helpful place to just get ideas out there and then try to, clean them up a little bit, actually on quote unquote paper, which aka my laptop,
Right,
once I
right.
was back near, a device.
Did you start when you decided to write this? Did you lay out? Did you have an outline of the structure, or did that kind of develop organically as you went?
Oh no, I definitely had an outline for the structure. I had an incredibly detailed outline for the structure. It was exhausting. I mean, one, I guess Guilford asked me to provide an outline, but I found that once I got an outline in my head of what I wanted to say and how I wanted to say it was really hard to not just start kind of writing within the outline. So fortunately, by the time that I had crafted the entire outline, the Guilford essentially said, like, no, we don't really need you to provide a sample chapter because you've written this exhaustive, like, 12, 13 page outline with all these paragraphs within it. And so like, it's fine. We've seen a lot. But I think that it was tremendously helpful to just always have that as a kind of a guide to go back to say like, okay, where am I supposed to be rooting myself, and how am I supposed to, bring this topic into the next one? And there was, some, I guess there was some tinkering that did have to happen at some points, and realizing that maybe certain sections didn't flow as logically into ones as we might have thought. But by and large, the outline is almost entirely the same.
And Guilford's your publisher. So you had a publishing contract before you actually sat down to write. And how did you work through an agent, or how did you find your publisher?
Word of mouth, actually, which is pretty awesome. I have a close friend mentor who has written in psychiatry, Nancy Rappaport, and she had known other people who had published in psychology and psychiatry, and she recommended to she I guess connected me to one of, I guess, her friends was a psychologist who had published with Guilford, and then asked for the I guess that Katie Moore, who was, I guess, the literary procurement editor, who kind of found me, or I found them. I actually, to be fair, I found them. I sent an email with a book proposal, and luckily it worked. So,
So how long did you spend writing?
oh, that's, I mean, it's hard to say considering it was in chunks, like over a period of time. But I would say I started, oh man, I want to say September, October of 2022. And then finished about, man, it's like June of 2024. And then like finally by like September 1st, I think was like the ultimate kind of, you have to have everything in by September 20. No, that can't be right. It must be 20. Man, sorry, I'm really confused. But that's not, all right. So let's backtrack a year. I guess I'd just given birth to my second child, and that was in August 2021. So I hadn't started writing it, I think, by then. So it must have been kind of that summer after that in 2022, and then to 2023 is primarily when I wrote it.
Okay, so once you finished that, what'd you do with all your all the free time you now had that you weren't writing a book?
Yeah, well, I guess the nice part about being like just doing all sorts of different things is that when you're a researcher, there is always extra stuff you can be doing that sometimes you can't fit it in. And there's no like hard and fast rule for like exactly how much you have to do. And while there are some deadlines, most of it's sort of free form. So, papers just sort of took the place, or, presentations for my research, that kind of thing. So
So,
just sort of substituting one out with the other.
you're used to writing research papers, which are for an academic audience. Was it at all challenging for you to write to, for a general audience?
No, not at all. I hate writing academically. I don't think I'm particularly good at it. I mean, I guess I can't be absolutely terrible at it, but I don't think I'm very good at it. And I'm very verbose in general, and I think that that lends itself better to a book for non-academics, perhaps. And I think just stylistically, I connect more with writing for, parents and well, I guess lay people than non-academics. I think academic writing is just so stilted and unfun.
So, and you do put a lot of sort of I wouldn't necessarily say anecdotes, but you take case studies in here, which are very interesting and very informative. And you also have a lot of kind of, you have a takeaway for each chapter. You have a lot of sidebars. Did you like do all that yourself, or did you have an editor help you with that?
Nope, that was all me.
That's all you. Wow. And how about the little drawings and
All me.
oh my goodness. Okay. Drawings and charts and wow. So are you going to write another book?
I would love to. I think, I've been mulling about kind of what that could look like, and I don't know. There's, several ideas that I have. I think I've become very passionate more recently about parents' mental health in general, especially parents' mental health, when their kids are struggling with psychiatric illness. So that's something I've been thinking about writing about more. But there's so many things I find that I feel very passionately about that it's hard to pick and choose, but also hard to know, what will be of most interest to people. I think what's hard is that I don't want, and especially didn't want to write a book that was very black and white in how it presented issues. I mean, A, because I think that's lying, but B, because I think that's not actually going to be of use to people, even though they might think that they want a black and white answer. That's misleading, and so I want to write a book, that has people recognizing that like nothing is going to be as simple as sometimes I think medicine convinces them that, I mean, the field of medicine convinces them that it should be. I think doctors have done, clinicians in general have done a kind of poor job for years, being overconfident and overselling our treatments, than actually we should have been. And so I think it's tricky to know whether or not that's like a good set, a good selling point, quote unquote, for a book is to see it, to
Well,
really
I can
emphasize the
see it
ambiguity of it.
definitely has some possibilities. I want to thank you for being with us today, Dr. Meredith Gansner,
Thank
author of
you.
Teen Depression Gone Viral. I'm going to use for our closing quote, there's a lot of celebrities that have come forward and talked about their own struggles with depression. And one of them is Michael Phelps, who one of the best athletes of all time, Olympic swimmer, who struggled a lot with depression. And he says, "It's okay to not be okay. Depression is a real illness, and you are not alone."
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you so much, and see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Thanks.